dealt with the key issue which sets the foundation for everything, the problem of the divisions, the looking at the wisdom of Jesus on the cross, telling them what his role is and Apollos' role is. He doesn't want them to be going out after leaders. This is not a personality cult thing. He's explained all that, I think, brilliantly. Now he gets to some of the things he's heard about from the community by Chloe's people or other rumours that have come back. Before he says, look, it's actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you of a kind that's not found even among pagans. The word for sexual morality here, immorality, is porneia. Pornos is a male prostitute. Porne is a female prostitute. So porneia technically and strictly means prostitution. But in its use, by the way, we get our word fornication. If you put the P and an F, porne, forne, same word. So it comes from that. So it came to be a general word used of sexually reprehensible behaviour. But sometimes you've got to watch it carefully because it may be the prostitution aspect that is key to it as well. So something's happening in the community that not even the pagans are doing. A man is living with his father's wife. Clearly not his mother, but his father's wife. So his father's married again. Another thing to keep in mind, by the way, when you read all this literature, which I had, sometimes, well, we all read things within our, we have assumptions. It took me a while, I mean, it's a long time ago now, to realise that in there, mostly with us, women outlive men. And that's the fact of it. But in those days, childbirth was quite a hazardous thing. And many women died in childbirth. And so it was common to have widowers and for men to outlive their wives and remarry. And in fact, another interesting thing, in the early history of the church, often the celibacy of the clergy was, they were celibates, post-marriage celibates. They were men who'd lived their married life and had their family, but their wife had died, and they were then free for a second career, as it were. And they often went into the church with that. I just say that. So he's a man living with his father's wife. You are arrogant. Should you not rather have mourned so that he who has done this would have been removed from among you? Arrogant is a possible translation. If I were translating it, I would say you are quite smug about it. They're saying, oh, this is fine. This is a sign of being broad-minded. We're Christians. We've got a big liberal view of the world. It's okay. You know, they're kind of... But he said you should be ashamed of it rather than smug about it. Who is this man that's doing it? I don't know. We're not given the information. But if you read between the lines, it's not impossible this person might be one of the patrons. Remember I said to you last week that Paul, for example, only baptized very few in the community. And patronage was a big thing in Corinth, in Rome too, but in Corinth, where 300,000 was the population, 200,000 slaves. So if people who came there for the games or for healing or for trade, which is the main thing between Europe and India and all the rest of it, and Egypt, so people who came there for trade, they'd have to know somebody who knew somebody to get into the inset. So if you became patron, so this person might be a person of quite considerable patronage, and therefore people might have been a bit afraid to criticise him because he had power over there, whatever. At least that's not unlikely. Well, Paul says, though absent in body, I'm present in spirit. And as if present, I have already pronounced judgment in the name of the Lord Jesus on the man who has done such a thing. So you're dealing here with, it's getting close to what we'll call excommunication, which is one of the powers the church still has. Thank God, the church must always keep that power. If I was preaching heresy in your parish or here, and it was known, I'm very glad we've got a system in the church where the bishop has power to say to me, stop preaching heresy, and shows me that it's heretical, it's not Catholic doctrine, and if I refuse to accept, he must sack me, mustn't he? And he must say, okay, well, you've put yourself out of communion with the community. Now, he doesn't do it to get rid of me. He does it to say, okay, well, we're not going to play games here. this is this and this. If you change, if you realise your mistake, if you come humility, if you do some study, if you go away and make a retreat, get yourself in order and stop all this pride and come back and realise what you're doing to people, but I'm not going to let you, either bishop, get up there Sunday after Sunday and teach this kind of stuff in the name of the church. You follow that, I'm sure. And that has to happen. Hopefully it would rarely need to happen. And it shouldn't happen without proper process and without the person knowing about it and without the person having the time to say, oh, look, I'm really sorry, I'll change it. And so, but here's Paul. He's made this judgment on this behaviour and very clearly. Version, which reads, I'll do it again. I have pronounced judgment in the name of the Lord Jesus on the man who has done such a thing. It's quite possible that the Greek can be read, I have already pronounced judgment on the man who has done such a thing in the name of the Lord Jesus. You see? That qualification could... It may be that the man is doing it in the name of the Lord Jesus. I'm a Christian, I'm free, all these fiddly little Jewish rules about incest and all that, we're beyond that, etc., etc. Alerting you to what strikes me in view of what he says as not only, it's quite possible that it may be the problem that this person is not only behaving like this but doing it in the name of being a Christian with his freedom. Right. When you are assembled and my spirit is present with the power of the Lord Jesus, you're to hand this man over to Satan for the destruction of his flesh so that his spirit, here's the purpose, spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord. So it's excommunication. The community has to say, no, you can't come to communion because what you're doing is against our faith. It's also causing bad example to the pagans around and all that, but it's not what Jesus is talking about. So you're excommunicated until you change, so that his flesh, he's losing his friends, he's losing faith, his whatever it happens to him in body by being excommunicated, is so that his soul, his spirit, his communion with God will be safe in the day of the Lord. And he continues, your boasting is not a good thing. Do you not know that a little yeast leavens the whole batch of dough? Clean out the old yeast so that you may be a new batch as you really are unleavened. For our paschal lamb, Christ, has been sacrificed. There's an image we're so used to, but this is its origin, first time we see it in writing. Our paschal lamb, Christ, has been sacrificed. Please know, some people have trouble with the word sacrifice, and I understand why you do, because you've heard horrific sermons in the past that were really ill-advised, in fact, off the planet. Sacrifice, you could think of pagan sacrifices. Almost God has a kind of bloodlust. We've offended God. God says, I'll only forgive you if you make up to me. So you people sacrifice a lamb in some of the Greeks. You remember the story of Iphigenia? Sacrificed on the, so that the winds, the gods of the winds would blow them towards Troy. And they'd sacrifice their children, Moloch, outside Jerusalem. The Ammonites did this. It's a common thing. And a lot of our ancient cultures we know about now, sacrifice. The thing most precious to you is sacrificed, and the gods apparently are happy. And then they pour the blood into these chthonic gods, the gods, not the gods of the Olympus, the sky, but the gods down there who love drinking in blood. So you'd pour out the blood of your own eldest son or your daughter, or if you didn't do that, it would be the best lamb or the best cow or the best, you know, whatever. This primitive fear stuff, because you're afraid of the gods, and there's plenty of them, and you've got to satisfy them all or things could go grim. Shocking, simple, still pretty common, this kind of psyche among us human beings. So all that stuff there, don't associate that with any of this. Sacrifice, look at the word, it means sacrum facere in Latin, to make sacred. It's to make holy. That's what it means. So a sacrifice is something that is holy, handed over into the Holy One. Jesus' sacrifice on the cross was his giving of himself The murder of Jesus was a sin. The shedding of blood was a sin. There's no chronic gods down there to drink in this. And God isn't saying, well, at last you've made up for your sin, so I'm satisfied. A horrible image, but it's around in some stupid sermons and terrible ancient mucked up theology. The only thing God wanted was love, and that Jesus loved, and that's what he asked him to do, and he gave his life. He loved to the end. And that's what God was just delighted with, and that's all he asks of you and me, to love. If people kill us, well, that's terrible, and God weeps. So Jesus, God wept on Calvary, but he didn't weep when he looked at his son and saw his son still believing, still loving, still offering himself into the presence of God, still holy in a very unholy place. So he is our paschal lamb, Jesus, sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the festival, not with the old yeast, the yeast of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. It could be that Paul is writing just after Easter. I mean, that he might be writing in the spring of 54 or 53, you know. And he might mean literally, we've just been through Holy Week. You know, we've just had our paschal sacrifice. It's quite possible, because they would have been celebrating Easter with a Christian view of things. Or it might be speaking more generally than that, going back to the crucifixion. Verse 9, I wrote to you in my letter, so here we get, I've mentioned it before, but the first time, Paul obviously has written them before. We don't know where the letter is, sadly. I wrote to you not to associate with sexually immoral persons, not at all meaning the immoral of this world, or the greedy and robbers and idolaters, since you'd need to go out of the world. Perhaps some in Corinth are laughing at Paul. Paul said, look, I don't want you to associate with people who are sinful in sexual matters. And I thought, good, help us. Who isn't sinful? And we're going to sit at home all day and watch TV or something. I mean, he said, look, I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about, of course you've got to associate with people in the world, and many of them living sexually immoral lives, especially Corinth. Corinth had a reputation for immorality. Up on the hill, the Acropolis of Corinth, ancient Corinth, you know, 200 BC, there was a temple which had supposed to have had 1,000 prostitutes. And there was a saying in Greek, going to Corinth meant going to prostitution, because it was so well known, this harbour, this port in between the two worlds where nobody knew anybody, and it was very mobile, and blokes on holidays that kind of go there and have it off with some prostitute, male or female, up in this big temple, all that stuff. Corinth had a reputation for that. That was the ancient Corinth, by the way. But the modern Corinth had similar problems, and though the temple was much smaller now, it's not unlikely that Corinth was a place, King's Cross, I don't know what, it was a place that reputation for lack of social cohesion and lack of the kind of things that happen when people belong and know each other, it was loose, and especially in this area. So he's saying, no, I didn't mean you couldn't mix with people like that. He wants to win them over to the faith. But he says, you'd need to go out of the world if you're going to do that. No, now I'm writing to you, I'm making myself clear now, so not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother or sister, meaning a Christian, who is sexually immoral or greedy or an idolater, reviler, drunkard or robber. That's what I was talking about. If people in the community continue to behave like this after their conversion, and they're coming along to the community and being part of the Eucharist and all that, and they're still living, still going off to the temple prostitution, well then make it clear to them this is not on and you can't do this. And they can't pretend. Don't even eat with such a one, for what have I to do with judging those outside? Nothing, says Paul. Isn't it those who are inside that we are to judge? God will judge those outside. Drive the wicked person from among you. Okay, so if this bloke is living with his father's wife, well, he must be excommunicated from the community so that his spirit will be saved and his behaviour will alter. Chapter 6 moves on to a second problem. When any of you has a grievance against another, don't dare to take it to court before the unrighteous, instead of taking it before the saints. If a problem arises in the community, don't go to a pagan court, because they can't judge according to Christian principles. The life you have as a body is the life of Christ. So surely you can find, I'll say better than I am now, but you people who reckon you're so wise, you people who reckon knowledge is what matters and you're really into it, haven't you got anyone in the community? Can't you come together and help sort this out from a Christian perspective? Please remember, they're only a small group in that pagan world. Many Christian principles are now working in our public system of judgment. It wasn't then, though. So, okay, he's kind of telling them, how wise are you if you're doing this? Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to try trivial cases? Do you not know that we are to judge angels, to say nothing of ordinary matters? He's really saying the whole world is going to be judged by love, by what Jesus has said, blessed are the poor. That's what really... Now, these are values you know as a community, so sort your problems out in the community. If you have ordinary cases, then, do you appoint as judges those who have no standing in the church, who have no criteria, no knowledge of what Christianity is supposed to be about? I say this to your shame. Can it be that there's no one among you wise enough to decide between one believer and another, but a believer goes to court against a believer and before unbelievers at that? In fact, to have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded? But you yourselves wrong and defraud, and you are believers at that. Paul's not saying it's good to be wronged. He's not saying lie down and accept it. He's saying it's better to be wronged than to be doing the thing wronging, to do the wronging to other people. It's better to be a victim of wrong and injustice than to be the one causing it. Because obviously people in the community are causing injustice to each other. To seek out an arbitrator within the Christian community who will help them, that's what he wants them to do, find true justice, enlightened by grace, and achieved through love. It may not always be possible, but that's what he's telling them to do. Here's Jesus, some of the things that Jesus said that pull us in that direction. I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. To qualify that, of course. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also, said Jesus. If anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go a second mile. Like every big wise statement, you've got to start sorting it and clarifying it, and we won't be able to do it here, but there's a principle there somewhere. The cheek thing, you know, we don't in Australia, we're starting to a bit, but you know how you offer one cheek and then you offer the other cheek in many of these cultures. That's the normal way of, so you kiss the person and they kiss you kind of thing. It's a mutual. Well, he's saying if you go out to greet someone and they reject your greeting, well, don't stop be a person who goes out and greets people. Don't give them that power over you. Don't you become like those who are refusing love. Don't react at the same level as those who are hurting you. Or as Paul says, don't respond with evil to evil. Don't respond with terror to terror. Or you create more terror, as we're seeing throughout our world at the moment. So that's not the way. There's another way to keep your soul pure and yourself free. And just to pull back a bit from this revenge and standing on your own rights by perhaps being unjust to other people. All of that, somehow that's in there. Here's Peter's first letter. When Jesus was abused, he didn't abuse. He didn't return abuse. When he suffered, he didn't threaten. When he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly, he kept his soul intact. Romans we'll read later, let your love be genuine, hate what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Don't repay anyone evil for evil, but take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, leave room for the wrath of God. A topic which we did at great length looking at 2 Thessalonians. Leave judgment to God. In other words, truth will sort itself out somewhere. Don't destroy yourself to get revenge for those who are destroying you. Now, all of that needs careful thought and teasing out, and I don't want to do it now. I haven't really the time, but just at least covering what Paul has said there.